Hello, lovelies. Sophia here. You've probably heard me talking on the podcast about how I run writing workshops with my team at a wonderful small business called Firefly Creative Writing. So before we get started with this episode, I want to let you know that I've created a new workshop coming up this fall, specifically for listeners of this podcast who are interested in exploring the FAT experience through writing. It's called, no surprise, the Fat Joy Workshop, and it's where I get to bring together my love and passion for body liberation, deep conversations, community building, and creative writing. Like all the workshops we run at Firefly, this is about connecting to the pleasure of writing, and you don't need to have any writing experience to do that. I'll be guiding us step by step through everything we do. So if you're feeling interested, but also a bit nervous, know that that's totally normal and that we've got you. Firefly has a beautiful way of bringing people together and creating brave, authentic spaces where big things can happen. This episode's conversation is such a powerful reminder of the power of writing our own experiences as fat people, of telling our stories in our own words, and entrusting our voices. The Fat Joy Workshop is specifically designed for people who identify as fat and have experienced stigma based on their body size. The workshop is also a cozy space. We keep this workshop at 7 participants. So if you want a spot in the workshop, please go ahead and book it soon because it will fill up pretty quickly. And I'm also so happy to be able to gift you $50 off the workshop with the offer code FATJOY. So check out the workshop at fireflycreativewriting.com. Link and the offer code are in the show notes, so you can get it there. And I really hope we get the chance to do some writing together. Enjoy the rest of the episode. Hello, lovelies. Welcome to the Fat Joy Podcast, where we talk each week about how to flourish in an anti-fat world. I'm Sophia Apostle, a fat professional coach who loves talking to other fat people about what it's like to live within oppressive systems that marginalize our bodies and how we still dare to have the audacity and courage to reach towards our collective liberation and embrace our joy. Please know this is an adult content podcast, so there will be swears, we will be talking about harms we've experienced, and we will be rebelling against weight stigma, diet culture, fat phobia, ableism, racism, etc. You can get more Fat Joy goodness, including how you can support the podcast, through my newsletter at fatjoy.substack.com. And for episode transcripts, book reviews, and show notes, head to the Fat Joy website at fatjoy.life. I am so glad you're here. Enjoy this episode. Hello, lovelies. Welcome back to the Fat Joy Podcast. I'm Sophia, and I am joined by Kate Mann today. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Sophia. It's so great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh. Kate, I'm very excited. Your book, Unshrinking, How to Face Fat Phobia, is circulating. It is making the rounds. It is like such a topic of conversation, and I'm so happy that we're going to get to talk about it. So thank you for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Pleasure and a privilege.
Kate, I was checking out your bio on your website, and you have done a lot of really cool things. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and the work that you do in the world?
Yeah, sure. So I am a philosopher by trade. I'm also Australian in terms of my origin and my rather silly hybrid Australian-American accent now. But I came to the States to go to grad school in philosophy. And then I became a professor at Cornell about 10 years ago. I started my professor job after a postdoc at Harvard. And I work on a number of things in philosophy, feminist philosophy, social philosophy, moral philosophy. That's kind of my training. But I'm especially interested in the topic of misogyny. So my first two books were about misogyny. And in the course of writing them and publicizing them, talking to people about misogyny, I found I would often be asked this question. Well, how did you get interested in misogyny? It's not very fun, as my four-year-old would say. It's a pretty grim topic to be fixated on. And I found I couldn't actually answer that question without also telling a story about fat phobia. Because back in Australia, I was a girl going into a previously all-boys school. The year it integrated in my high school in Australia, those last 2 years, I was one of three girls amid hundreds of boys. And I was, I know.
Whoa.
I'll pause to let you react to.
Yeah, that's a big transition. So this is like last years of high school, imagine similar to here. So like grade 11 and 12, you're like 17, 16, 17, 18 year olds. Okay. Tell us what happened.
So yeah, I was, I would say a chubby teen, at most small fat, probably not even that. I think I was probably still in straight sizes for the most part then. And I was, still mercilessly bullied and belittled on account of being, somewhat fat. And that's an identity that today I just fully embrace. But at the time, I was really ashamed of my body. The misogyny really did take the form of things like calling me a fat bitch. That was scrawled in my locker in permanent ink, so I just had to wear that. I think they eventually removed it, but it was there for a long time. My locker was doused in fish oil to kind of indicate how disgusting women are. I was voted the person most likely to have to pay for sex at the high school leavers assembly. So that was my prize. My superlative was most likely to have to pay for sex as an adult. Yeah, it was a really traumatic 2 years. And so like it was a lot of weaponized fat phobia in service of misogyny. And so obviously I became really interested throughout my life in understanding the links between misogyny and fat phobia, and also just what misogyny and fat phobia accomplish in the world, both as systemic forms of oppression that intersect with every other major form of oppression, and what they do to people as they internalize some of these harmful norms. So that's kind of my villain origin story. I have been trying to understand these forces that I faced and didn't really have words for at the time, back when I was 16 and 17 in my academic work, with the thought that I just think, look, preaching to the choir gets a bad name, but my thought is we often don't yet know our song. And I see myself as in community with people like you, with a whole community of fat activists and organizers and scholars and writers, and also people who are at, you know, the forefront of intersectional feminist thinking, where we're trying to figure out how do we tell our stories and how do we articulate, put words to experiences that otherwise are confusing, inchoate, involve forms of gaslighting, where we're not even allowed to name what has happened to us. Because we feel either kind of quote unquote crazy or guilty and ashamed for our perception of what was going on. That's kind of my jam academically and in terms of my public writing, that these three books are all meant for a more general and non-academic audience as well as for other academics too.
Yeah. My heart is still with teenage Kate right now. I mean, I love that you were able to take that and alchemize it into what has become a beautiful, very cerebral exploration. But I'm also like, okay, I like your poor teenage self. Like, what was the process? And again, anything I ask, feel free to be like, no, too personal, because this is, I think, a personal one, but like, how did you develop enough distance from that deeply traumatic experience to be able to bring an academic lens to it? Like, I feel like that's a process.
You know, I think a lot of it for me is it is the way that I process trauma is very distant, intellectualized, non-visceral, very calm, very reasoned, And it's how I kind of think through bit by bit, step by step, very analytically, well, what exactly is this system, these institutional as well as interpersonal forces, what are they doing to people? What do they accomplish in the world? What's their inner logic? Because to some extent, misogyny makes sense. Like the way I theorize it is it's a series of down girl moves is one way that I put it in my first book. And the book is called Down Girl. It's like a way of saying to girls and women who are on male turf or who are too outspoken or perceived as too loud, too big, too much as taking up space in a man's world effectively. It's saying to us, be smaller, be quieter, be silent. And analyzing that, it takes what can feel like something coming at you confusingly and violently and confrontingly into something where you can stand back and see what's going on, and it's not about you anymore. It is coming at you. And as I say in that book, like if your effigy is your body, you burn along with it. This is not to say that this doesn't affect you, but it's to say it is a very hostile personal attack oftentimes, but it is leveled at you as a kind of representative woman or fat woman or whatever particular intersecting identities or social positions you occupy there as a way of defending against the world changing in ways that I believe it should. And I think all your listeners will agree the world should be changing in these egalitarian and progressive ways to allow us all to occupy spaces without a sense of gender hierarchy or bodily hierarchy. But yeah, trying to understand these forces in this analytical way, I think is how I have done that processing.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah, it's reminding me of the way my own journey went from body positivity into fat liberation. Because for me, the fat liberation was really about understanding beyond just my own body, but understanding the systems that were in play, the anti-oppressive systems that were designed very intentionally to make me feel the way I felt about my body. And there was something about suddenly that being taken from body positivity, which feels like it's so about just love my body, which is great, but from internal to external, and like really being able to examine it and pick it apart and realizing, oh, this is a construct. I don't have to. And then suddenly now I had choice in a new way.
Absolutely. You can opt out of something that's imposed on you for, frankly, profit, for late stage white supremacist, capitalist, misogynistic, ableist, ageist profit. And yeah, so being able to see what it's all doing in the world, I think, is actually really healing. It doesn't mean there's not other parts of that work that are the kind of thing I would and have explored with therapists, past and current. But it also, I think, there is a role for liberating thinking in the academy and beyond that helps us like locate where we are in social space and, yeah, not feel that it's us and not feel broken or again, quote unquote, crazy, but like, no, the system, that's the problem. And that's what we have to come together in solidarity to fight against.
Yeah. Okay. One of my biggest questions is, why is it so hard for so many people to see through the systems? Like family members, friends, people who love me dearly. It's like, and I take this very personally and I'm working on not, but I almost take it as in they don't, it's almost like, but it feels to me is like they don't love me enough to see through so that they can be on my side. And that feels so painful. And I know that is my own thing and that is kind of faulty reasoning, but it just highlights to me like not even the deepest love between family members can overcome the effectiveness of these systems. And that's like one of my biggest puzzlements in life right now.
Now that is a real puzzle. And I think it's a philosophically interesting puzzle. And one of the things that I think may be going on among others is fat phobia among other systems of oppression, is rife with, in its ideology, what I would often refer to when I'm doing this work as thought-terminating cliches. So, like, a thought-terminating cliche would be, like, the mantra that calories in, calories out, which we just know is false. I can get into the reasons, but I'm sure, you know, that will certainly not be news to you. It won't be news to the majority of your listeners that bodies actually process calories differently and people's metabolisms slow down after weight cycling and intentional weight loss that is incredibly hard on the human body. And our bodies get into processes of weight restoration because it's bodies being bodies and doing their jobs, and people coming in different shapes and sizes is actually as we should be and is a beautiful part of human diversity, blah, blah, blah. But the thought terminating cliche, calories in, calories out, or but isn't being fat just unhealthy, for another incredibly powerful combination of dog whistle, because unhealthy there codes for so much morality, among other things. They like stop people being able to analyze, okay, well, what's really going on when we say this? What's the argument exactly? What's the evidence for it? Is it borne out? Are there counter arguments or counter evidence I should consider? And it's not to say that someone shouldn't be able to fight through that out of love and respect and compassion for anyone, especially someone who is beloved to them. But it is that there is a barrier to thinking that, again, is by ideological design. It's kind of meant to interrupt critical thought, and it's like a thought end. It's an end to the sentence. It puts a period on it rather than inviting the kind of questioning and opening up of discursive space that I think, you know, would be much more fruitful. Does that make any sense as like part of the answer?
Yeah, because that's what it feels like. It is like, oh, there's nowhere to go now.
It's like those sentences are like haunting someone's head and you can't break through it, to me oftentimes. Like, does that make sense that there's a mantra that's kind of taking up all the space that might otherwise be like a place to get curious and find room for discourse and back and forth? There's actually nowhere to go in a conversation dominated by one person being mired in, but this is just this,
right? That dogma, that judgment. And, you know, what I learned when I did some like a neuroscience of coaching program was that our brains are not wired to be both in judgment and in curiosity at the same time. It's like an on-off switch. And so I've thought a lot about that with these, I love this phrase, the thought terminating cliches. It's so rooted in, like you said, like a judgment, a morality, like just this is the way it is. Like there is no room for curiosity, and therefore there's nothing to flip that switch into curiosity, because we can only have, they turn each other on and off, judgment and curiosity.
That is a perfect complementary explanation for why there's actually something that is making people incapable of flipping from the mode of here's the facts, even though those facts are manifestly not true. They're not facts. They're not something someone knows because they're false assumptions and false beliefs. But it becomes incredibly difficult to offer them a piece of evidence as counter evidence because they're not in that receptive, curious mode of, oh, okay, well, how would that bear on what I'm about to say? How does the fact that contestants in The Biggest Loser had a metabolism 30% slower on average 5 years after their original weight loss, how does that bear on what I just said? They're not having that conversation with themselves. They're not really having a conversation with you either. They're being part of this process of ideologically shutting down certain avenues that this work that you're doing and that I'm trying to contribute to too is all about opening up.
Yeah. So have you solved the problem?
No. And also, I'm a diagnostician. I'm not a solutions person.
Oh, man.
But I will say this. I think it is interesting that a conversation can go nowhere and still be useful down the line.
You know what? That's actually very true. That is very true. We never know, because I remember instances of people who were much more liberated than I was throughout my life. And I still remember little nuggets of things they said that I completely rejected at the time, extremely closed-minded. And then now I'm like, oh, I need to find that person from like grade 9 and like thank them for depositing that. And so maybe it's not all a loss, but yeah, it is so interesting that is, even like in like the examination of this problem through a philosophical lens, it's like, and that's it. That is the end of where it can go in that moment. So I kind of hang on to that. I think, okay, for right now, this is where it is. But you know, I'm going to hold hope for movement or curiosity in the future, perhaps.
I mean, I will say there's another facet to this that is in a way even grimmer, which is weight gives people, you know, as you well know, a kind of linear way of ranking bodies. Almost everybody gets just ranked in rough inverse proportion to their body mass. And of course, it's somewhat complicated by, you know, various forms of bodily privilege, and certainly complicated by race and gender identity and all sorts of intersections and disability and age and whatnot. But it makes for the basis for an initial ranking of people on this hierarchy. And so it isn't surprising in a way that people who are higher up this hierarchy are often incredibly reluctant to give up their privilege, and who they're so invested in where they are as a person who is thin or straight-sized, or at least thinner than someone who is in a larger body. They really don't want to admit that that is just one way of having a body, and having a body that's larger is another valid way of having a body, and there's just no value attached to being fatter or thinner. There's really no moral, intellectual, sexual, or I think, you know, I would also add health status is just also this absolute crapshoot where there is just no way of reading someone's health up their body size. So having to give up your hierarchical position, that can be tough. And it can even be tough for people who are fat and who are desperately trying to climb the hierarchy by getting thinner, and who don't want to be in solidarity with people their size and larger folks, because they want to be clawing back hierarchical privilege, and they want to be like thinking of themselves almost like as a fat person with a thin person waiting to emerge victorious, which, you know, will be presumably a brief victory, if at all, because the vast majority of people who do manage to lose weight temporarily will experience weight restoration. But that idea that people are not going to form the kind of solidaristic connections with others, I think that's part of it too, because they're not thinking of weight as a facet of human diversity that, sure, waxes and wanes somewhat, but often for those of us who are larger, it's a pretty permanent state of affairs, at least while we're fortunate enough to be well enough to have the ability to keep flesh on our bones. And yeah, so it takes a lot to give up that idea of, well, I'll be higher on the hierarchy next year, next month, next week. Does that make sense too?
It does. It really does. I remember hearing Sonya Renee Taylor talk about the body hierarchy ladder. And I remember it was years ago when I heard that, and it the image of that and people clawing their ways to the top made so much sense as a metaphor for this. And what's interesting too is I find that I really agree a lot of people are really loath to let go of their status. But what's so interesting to me is, again, so much of that, when I've tried to talk to people about it, they really reject that idea. So it's like it feels like a very unconscious belief. And again, I have at least with my very limited powers of communication, I have found no way through yet for like the people I really care to have those conversations with. And there's such a rejection of, no, I would never, because then that also brings up their morality as if they're a bad person. It's like saying, I am white, therefore I am racist. I can't not be. But like, that's a really hard thing for a lot of white people to acknowledge, right?
Yeah, no, I was thinking that is, I think, a really fair parallel. And it's not to say there aren't differences or, you know, ways in which the situations are interestingly disanalogous as well as intersecting. But yeah, as well as Sonia Renee Taylor's metaphor there, I was thinking about Kimberly Crenshaw, the kind of founder of intersectionality, the brilliant theorist and law professor, and just her idea of intersectionality as kind of a basement where people who have various forms of intersecting privilege are kind of at the bottom of a basement trying to claw their way up via this ladder. But the only people who have access to the top rung of the ladder are the ones who only have one form of serious systemic oppression affecting them. And so they kind of escape and get up to where they need to be, you know, in the light of day, while so many people are left without like access to the means to, have that same kind of opportunity and freedom and liberty. So yeah, I think similarly, a lot of these conversations get ground down quickly, and there's no easy way to say to someone, look, you're invested in ways that are kind of shameful in hierarchies that are really oppressive. But there it is, do better. It's true in the case of many systemic forms of oppression, and yet a lot of people will not be ready to hear that they are benefiting from and invested in white privilege, thin privilege, and so on and so forth.
And yet the challenge, of course, is that our world can't shift until more and more people reckon with that truth. Which is why we're having this conversation today.
Because we just keep chipping away.
Right? Yeah, bit by bit. So how did you know you needed to write this deeply personal book?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of an embarrassing answer to it in a way, because I discovered fat activism when I was, for the first time, I would say genuinely fat as a young adult. And I discovered work by people like Kate Harding and Marion Kirby and Leslie Kinzel. I discovered the fatosphere, and it struck me immediately as completely correct and deeply liberating. And I was all in politically. And then I didn't talk about it or enact it in my personal life for about 25 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Relatable. So relatable. Yeah.
It took me 2 decades at least to really come to terms with what it would mean to give up diet culture, to give up this desire to get to the end of thinness via these certain behaviors, like really disordered eating. And I think I am so not alone in this. So really the impetus to write this book came from becoming a mother and getting into my most disordered eating territory and losing a lot of weight that way, because I've been a much larger person than I currently am. I currently identify as a small fat person to acknowledge my privilege on the fat spectrum, but I've been much larger than I am now. I'm still, I think, in the process of weight restoration. But when I did lose that weight, I was just praised and congratulated by doctors when I was really ill, like really needed help. And it was reflecting that I didn't want to see my daughter watch me starve myself anymore. That made me think, I just have to like actually deal with this once and for all. I have to really deal with this in therapy. I have to write about this. I have to put my politics into practice in ways that are real for the first time. And that is what sent me on the path of writing this book, to say that I really believe in fat liberation. And I really think that there needs to be a politics that is strengthening in ways that I'm not necessarily seeing. I'm seeing us going backward, in fact, around a coalition of people who are devoted to body liberation of all kinds.
Yeah, yeah. I love that your journey started almost as like a love, or this book could be like a love letter to your daughter.
It really is. Yeah.
Yeah. And like a beautiful way to reshape lineage too, right?
I hope so. I see this incredibly amazing little person who has such an unselfconscious and joyous relationship with food and with her body. And I'm like, I just can't bear for the world to compromise that. And of course, I can't stop it from being exposed to all of the bullshit that we get exposed to, but I can do what my friend Virginia Soule Smith talks about in her book Fat Talk, of like having those conversations that hopefully give her critical tools to deal with all of the rubbish she'll encounter, and the message that, you know, in this household, we value everybody and regard size diversity as real and beautiful and valuable, just as we regard diversity in skin tone and hair texture and any number of other features as important and part of valuing each other in community, with no buts, no limitations, no exclusion. So yeah, that's the kind of ethos that we're trying to raise her with. And yeah, it feels like I kind of needed to put myself on the line more in order to do that fully.
Right. Again, if it's personal, tell me, but it's making me think about how my partner had to go through his own liberation journey because I was coming in with mine. And I'm just thinking about you and your partner both raising your daughter, and like that it actually kind of has to, well, I think it doesn't have to be, but I think it works best when it's a whole family endeavor. So was that a learning curve for?
We always kind of believed these things intellectually, but actually putting them into practice, like we had to become that couple who, you know, has listened to every episode of Maiden in Space at roughly the same time so we can talk about it and like, yeah, be serious about it and have that dialogue that means that we're on the same page about how, you know, if my daughter wants ice cream every day for a month, we're not going to panic about that. We're actually going to lean into it and be like, we don't restrict food. That's cool. That's great. With the ironic result that like, it's actually no big deal to her. She enjoys it and it's not something she fixates on because it's just not something that like we've put, sense of the forbidden around. So yeah, this is absolutely part of our like journey. The three of us, our whole family. And I would say, yeah, it just, is kind of an important part of learning to become parents together.
Yeah, that's beautiful that you've been able to do that together. I mentioned I was talking earlier to Crystal Maldonado, and she was saying the same thing for her. The birth of her daughter also really impacted her, and her and her partner, yeah, they're like cycle breakers, you know, with even within their families, and not only dialogue within the three of them, but dialogue with, you know, grandparents and like other family members, the whole circle.
Yeah. It can be challenging to say, like, we don't even use the word healthy about food. Like because healthy, like, of course, like health is good and health is important. It's not the only important thing. It's not even the most important thing, but the word healthy around food and bodies becomes a dog whistle for, will it make you thin? Is the body thin? Like, and having the conversation with a like very well-meaning grandparent who nonetheless is really invested in diet culture and who's like, oh, that meal looks healthy. It's like, even that, we're like, this meal is delicious and it's going to satisfy us. And let's keep our conversation off the... Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? Because it's hard to say what I think, which is, oh, you just used a dog whistle really unwittingly for going to make us all thin, which is A, false, and B, is not a valid goal that we share. And I wish you would give it up too, because it's you know, really probably not serving you. And I say this with love and compassion, but that's a long sentence. And so, and it's not necessarily one that will be received in the way that it's intended as constructive, like, let's change the norms, but I still love you way. It's more perceived oftentimes as like an outright attack. So navigating that, I think, is really hard. But I will say that my dad read my book and my mother-in-law read my book, and they were like, this is really powerful and I haven't thought about this before, and thank you. And my mother-in-law, who I've definitely had conversations where we have been like, let's like not talk about this or that, you know, it meant so much to me that she said that she cried and that it resonated with her as someone who, again, very understandably was sent a lot of damaging messages throughout her life. So yeah, again, like, I think we chip away at these things and they're hard and the conversations don't necessarily always go the way we would like, but I guess I have a little bit of optimism that they can get there bit by bit, when especially there are children involved. Sometimes that insistence can feel like very necessary and very fraught and impolitic. And I'm not a very confrontational person. So yeah, let's just say I still struggle to put this into practice in a way that feels constructive, but also like firmly drawing boundaries around conversations that I want my daughter to be clear. Like, of course she'll hear them, but I want her to be clear about her parents' position with respect to them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, beautifully. Oh, I love that. It's so clear. Yeah, it's almost the phrase in my head is like, we hold the center. Like, that is what we do. I don't know why that popped in my head. I have another, I'm just going to lob all my philosophical conundrums at you. Okay. Is it possible to be rooted in anti-diet culture, anti-fat phobia, and still intentionally lose weight? I feel like this is becoming a whole interesting, perhaps more nuanced conversation. I don't know, but I'm noticing this more and more as people are kind of getting past the surface level understanding and implications of liberatory thinking and fat liberation. And now it's like, is there a yes and? And I am all over the place with it. I have no idea. So I'm curious if there's something you've thought about too.
I have quite a bit, because look, I think there are a lot of people who are, let's put it this way. I'm not sure that there is a way to be all in body liberation, fat liberation, anti-fatness or anti-fat phobia, anti-diet culture, and really pursue intentional weight loss as a goal, as opposed to a potential side effect of other health behaviors. However, lots of us are somewhere on the spectrum of where some way towards being divested from diet culture, but maybe we're not all the way there, or we are on a journey towards that, but we're also like subject to a lot of ambivalence in our own lives. And I have like nothing but love and compassion for anyone who is not fully there or who is conflicted, because those are somewhat different things, being kind of most of the way there, but not quite, or being subject to inner conflicts and turmoil. Yeah, I think that is really normal and natural and makes sense. And I think that is really tricky. I'll also say that there are a range of exceptions to this rule, where one way to look at it is the world as steeped as it is in fat phobia can make certain things just really inaccessible for people in very large bodies, who may pursue intentional weight loss, not because they think it's intrinsically valuable, but because it's instrumentally valuable for them to get access to healthcare, to get access to employment, to get access to education. We know the forms of fatphobic discrimination in those areas of life and many more are rampant. So for someone who's pursuing intentional weight loss because that is sort of a devil's bargain that they've made, and that is the best way for them to survive in a deeply fatphobic world. Again, I think that's definitely possible, that they would be all in fat liberation, but pursuing this for merely instrumental reasons. But yeah, I think that what I would want for people in an ideal world, and we're very far off from having one, is that people could be all in and able to really forego the goal of intentional, or the practice of intentional weight loss and the goal of being thinner. I think that is still a worthwhile goal that, again, isn't accessible to many people, but it ought to be. Does that make any sense?
It does. It does. And that's kind of, yeah, it's kind of like... I would say the analogy for me is, I would love to live in an anti-capitalist way, and yet I still need to pay my mortgage. You know, like it's this, the system sets up like an inherent contradiction. So I can have these ideals and this belief and actions that follow it, but that it's going to bump into all the forces that are saying, no, you have to do it this way.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah. And I feel like that is the tension that causes stress and rage and hopelessness in our world.
Completely. And I mean, here's another way that I often put it is, I'm also just a huge believer, like most of my intersectional feminist ilk, in bodily autonomy. And if someone does want to pursue intentional weight loss, I think they're totally entitled to. I just worry most about people who feel obligated to, when that's a false moral obligation. And I also think that, and this is like the more controversial piece of it, there is something cool, gutsy, courageous, just kind of badass about not pursuing intentional weight loss, about like just being who we are in a fatphobic world, for those of us with, again, this is a very non-trivial condition, the privilege to be able to do that. I think that is like good for that person, good for all of us if we manage it. And I don't think it's an obligation. I think it's like an above and beyond kind of thing, where someone who is able to be like, no, this is my body, this is me, I'm not going to go down these roads, I admire that person. And I hope I am, you know, as my body gets into like more of the weight restoration that I think is coming, I hope I become that person to others. And I think that's worthwhile, even though I don't think that someone who is just not ready for that and who does end up pursuing intentional weight loss, I don't think that they are bad or shameful or should be condemned. I think they're entitled to do it. And I think if they did have the privilege, it would be even cooler if they didn't.
Yeah, yeah. You talk in your book about body reflexivity. How is that connected to what we're just talking about right now?
So I was so struck when you talked about going from a body positive mindset or framework to a fat liberation one. And I have very much been on a similar trajectory, I think, where the book as a whole is like premised on the idea that, yeah, we need body liberation. We need fat liberation specifically. We need a robust politics of anti-fat phobia in all of its intersections with all the other systemic forms of oppression, like racism, misogyny, ageism, ableism, homophobia, transphobia, and all the rest. But I got to the end of the book and there was this question that kind of nagged at me, which is, okay, like, but how do I feel about my body? That's still a question. Like, it still survives all of the political shifts that the book as a whole is meant to be reflective of, those shifts within our movements. And body positivity doesn't work very well for me. I'm not a very positive person about anything.
I just love hearing you say that. Not many people will say that, even though they are that. I love it.
I'm energetically pessimistic and kind of negative. And that's my like role in life. Like there needs to be people like me as well as people who are more upbeat. Like I'm someone who likes to kvetch and complain about injustice and, you know, feeling relentlessly positive about my body is a demand that feels kind of toxic to me. It feels like toxic positivity. I don't begrudge anyone for whom it works, but it just didn't feel like a good fit for me psychologically. And body neutrality is closer to what I believe in, but it honestly feels like a bit wan, a bit lackluster, a bit depressing to be like, well, I'm just merely neutral about my body in every way at you know, every day. And I began to think at the end of the book, well, why do we need to be positive or neutral, except if there was this prospect of negativity? Like, what if we threw out the scale, the implicit quantification altogether? What if we had the idea that the body is just not there for assessment or comparison or correction or contrasting with that of others? And so my mantra became, and it just kind of popped into my head, and it's my one mantra as a philosopher, because contrary to popular belief, I don't actually come up with aphorisms. But this one has stuck with me. It's like, my body is for me, your body is for you, and our own perspective on our bodies is the only one that matters for every person and every, I would say, non-human animal in the world too. Our body is for ourselves and no one else. And that kind of attitude, I ended up coining the idea or the term for it of body reflexivity, that idea that my body is just for me. And I found it was a way to drain self-criticism from my own gaze towards myself. Whatever my mood is coming to look in the mirror or put on clothing or whatever it is, when I reflect that my body is for me, it just takes the focus off how well it conforms to certain arbitrary dictates to, okay, how does it serve me? How does it feel? And it might be a good or bad feeling, or it might be a day where things aren't going so well. Like, we can have grief. We can have a sense of, you know, anger at our own bodies sometimes because we're experiencing chronic pain, which is bad for people to experience. And at the same time, a great deal of self-compassion and self-love through that, you know, the endless vicissitudes of health and wellness and illness and disability that most people, if we're privileged enough to have the longevity, will experience. But yeah, this idea that my body is for me is body reflexivity in a nutshell. And yeah, it's about, there's just no need to assess the body. Much as like when I see my four-year-old running around with her little friends at preschool, like imagine how creepy it would be to be like body positive or neutral or negative about four-year-olds. Like, we actually only do the assessment when it comes to girls who are a bit older and women for the most part. Being judgmental about the body is not an inevitable feature of human nature. It's a misogynistic flex, and we can stop it.
Yeah. Oh my God. I want you to say that again. That is so powerful.
Thank you. I was thinking too of the Twitter account We Rate Dogs, and it's a parody site because we don't rate dogs. We don't rate sunsets. We don't rate leaves. We don't rate flowers. We don't like walk around having to be positive about facets of the natural world. We can just be like appreciative. And the attitude that I want to have and that I want my daughter to share is how wonderful that we're here in this world together as bodies. Like, how wonderful to share a world with people who look different than me, who look the same as me, who have every range of size and shape and disability and skin tone and hair texture and facial differences and limb differences. And just, I remember in the pandemic, just showing her bodies because we were so isolated as a family with just the attitude like, how wonderful. Let's be grateful and glad that we're here in the world together for now. So yeah, that's how I tend to think about it. We can just not judge bodies at all.
Yeah. Well, and I just love that idea of really kind of pinpointing, this is when we start judging bodies. So let's just not. Like, I mean, that would, I mean, can you, I can barely imagine the ripple effect, total transformation that would have in our world. Like, that's, yeah.
Isn't it striking that, like, we don't have to do this? Like, we know what it's like to not do this. There's like the majority of people, we probably don't do this with as an automatic matter. It's just that it's so ingrained in patriarchal ideology that judging girls and women in this way at a certain age of like roughly kind of reproductive, labor being exploitable, roughly at that age, we start seeing a certain class of bodies as ripe for assessment. And so I think the more radical move that is in line with a radical politics of bodily autonomy and liberation and fat liberation and allied with trans liberation and queer pride and disability pride and, you know, all of the important pride movements that have come before and are very much ongoing and needed in our world, this attitude of, for the personal piece of it, my body is for me, it just really jibes with that way of thinking about, yeah, who a body is for, their denizen and no one else.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. When I was trying to, because I am not a philosopher, I am a doer. And so I often will experience concepts like what you're talking about, like the concept of fat liberation, and then try to figure out, okay, how do I action this into my life? And one of the things that I did, even though I didn't know this is what I was doing until you just described body reflexivity, and now I'm realizing, I think what I did that felt really effective, and I'm sharing in case it's helpful for anyone else, is I started to do what I would call desire days, where I would book off a day, a month, sometimes a half a day, whatever I could. And it was like, and I would do it during the week. So, you know, kids are in school, partner's working. Like, I literally would just have a chunk of time. Even sometimes I would go away for like 2 or 3 days to like an Airbnb or something, and it would be a desire weekend, which was lovely. But the idea was, I will, as much as I can, and this was the practice, attune to my full self, especially my body, because at that point, my body felt very disconnected. I felt very disconnected from my body. I will attune to my full self, focus on my body, and do what it desires. Because that idea of like, my body is for me. So can my body tell me what to do? And it was this practice, probably for about 2 years, pretty consistently, of like, okay, my body's in pain. It just wants to lie down, and no judgment. That was the other rule, was no judgment. Okay, we lie down. All right, my body wants to sit in the chair for 2 hours and have the sun move over her face. Okay, cool. That's what we're going to do. Okay, now my body wants to watch Netflix. Cool. Now my body wants to go for a walk. Cool. Now my body is hungry. Like, and it was just this like being in deep, unencumbered, uninterrupted relationship with my body in a way that I never have before. But I actually am realizing now, Kate, that I think what I was trying to train myself to do was body reflexivity.
Oh, I love that. That's so powerful. I mean, that is so in line with the idea that kind of inspired it and precedes it in the book of bodily imperatives. Because to me, the body is full of these demands, mandates, but also like quieter suggestions. There is so much that everybody, a person, but also a non-human animal, is like basically, if we're able to tune into it, and it sounds like you were doing some really amazing work to be able to do that, because it is a skill and it's something I'm actually not very good at. Because I'm a thinker, not a doer, or a practitioner, you know, I'm a diagnostician, not a solutions person. But I do think there's like some deep wisdom in the body that, like, if we can tune into it, and this is very much the skill and the set of wisdom that I think of as being channeled by people who, like me, practice intuitive eating and those who help others practice intuitive eating too, but like being able to tune into what does our body, what is it actually asking for? What does it maybe demand or maybe just desire, want? That I find that a really powerful, liberating practice. And it also reminds me of some of the amazing work done under the aegis of pleasure activism, and also like thinking about, the idea of rest as resistance that Trish Hersey has, made, amazing work, kind of concretize her idea there, which is so powerful and so liberating, especially for racially marginalized folks who are often deprived of rest. There is a lot there. It also brought up for me the Audre Lorde quote of self-care as a deeply political act.
Right. Yeah. So interesting how all of these threads come together so beautifully. And I'm just going to stretch the metaphor. And I just, I really hope we can braid all of this together into a better world, because it feels, I often joke, like, I love that you said you're not naturally optimistic. I am basically rage filled 97% of the time.
How could you not be?
How could we not be? Right. And then I'm like, and then I have these conversations and I'm 3% hopeful. Perfect. And it's like, it really, but it feels worthwhile. It feels worthwhile to have these conversations. It feels worthwhile to engage with people who might be closed, even if it's just planting a seed. And I think books like yours, being part of the discourse, lending your voice, your stories, lending your body in a way that hopefully doesn't sound extractive when I say it.
It's true.
Yeah. So that we can find the thread that each of us can follow forward, you know?
Yeah. I really love that.
Yeah. I want to come to joy, Kate.
Yeah.
What is your, and again, I love that you're a philosopher, because I'm like, philosophically speaking, like, what do you think joy is? What is joy to you?
It's really interesting, because I was thinking before we had this conversation that joy is not as theorized in philosophy as a lot of other concepts in the vicinity. And maybe I'm dismissing this vast literature, and I'm sure there are many individual papers and so on, but it's not like one of our buzzwords. Our buzzwords are things like well-being, happiness, or eudaimonia, flourishing, the Aristotelian term for it, the idea of like what makes a life go well, what makes for a valuable life. Pleasure and desire are very much like words that we are kind of stock in trade. But joy is an interesting one, because it is not something that I have like a ready-to-hand theory to like pull out of my sleeve of. And where I go to mentally is particular kinds of experiences that feel to me like they're not just pleasurable. I mean, pleasure can be deep for sure, but it's a combination of pleasure and meaning, which I, like, I was thinking of that phrase, which I think is false, but that parenting is no fun, all joy. I don't think it's all joy, and I think it's occasionally fun. However, there's something that they're getting at there, which is that particular highlights of parenting amidst, like, I would say parenting is like lots of fun, lots of joy, and also lots of intense boredom and like quite a lot of discomfort and irritation. So it's kind of more of a mixed bag. My title would be much less catchy, like, but the joy of it is like the combination of like really something being like very pleasurable hedonically, like just like, you know, the smell of your kid's hair, or like snuggling and reading a story, or, you know, them saying, like my girl saying, I love you so much, mommy. You're my squishy little mommy, which like, you know, it's like, oh, like, you see me, like I am like kind of squishy little mommy, my current incarnation. And or I want to be squishy with you. Like, that to me is so much joy, because it's, you know, it's pleasure, but it's combined with a lot of meaning, that these are moments that are special and intense, and also ones that, like, have a role in like an overall meaningful life. Not that there aren't a million other ways to have a meaningful life other than parenthood, but it's just one example of one way meaning can enter into pleasurable experiences that makes for joy, I think.
Yeah. Oh, I literally just wrote down joy equals pleasure plus meaning as an equation. So
I think that's, I am not going to vouch for that analysis, but it feels like there's something in the vicinity that feels core. I don't think it's like an adequate definition by any means. I bet it's not defensible. I bet I could think of three counterexamples if you gave me like 5 minutes, but I think it might be like the core of it for me, at least, is like that combination.
I really like that. I've not thought of it in that way before, but as even as you were describing it, I felt the truth of that. I was like, oh yeah. Cause I think like this morning, it's finally getting warmer up here where I am, close to Toronto in Canada. And I'm sitting out on the front porch, my sweet puppy girl beside me, and I have my coffee, and I was like, ah, joy. And it's because there was the pleasure, but you know, the meaning piece is really interesting, because I've not thought about this before in this way. The meaning for me was, how lucky am I that I am self-employed and I can take this 20 minutes. I have a timer set. I can fully let go of watching time, be in this moment, pet my dog, stop her from barking at all the other movement, and just like the meaning of my, like, almost, I mean, really almost like my whole life built to that one moment. Like, that was deep. It was steeped in meaning. So when you're saying the meaning piece, I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what I felt this morning. Joy as pleasure and meaning. Yeah. Very cool. Thank you, Kate. You are so incredible. I could listen to you talk. I'm so glad you're a professor. I think your students are so lucky. The way you describe things feels so informed and yet also so accessible. And I think that's a really hard thing to do. I used to work in higher ed. I've also been a sessional instructor. And I think taking complex things and having them be both informed, educational, and accessible is actually a really hard balance to strike. And you do it so beautifully, Kate. And I'm really grateful for this conversation and so grateful that your work is out there.
That is so nice, Sophia. I am so grateful for your work and just like to be in community with an amazing thinker and activist like you. It does feel like, if I may, like it is very joyful for me, because I'm someone who has like been deeply attracted to fat liberationist work since I was 20. And it's taken me this long to actually get to have these kinds of deeply, pleasurable and meaningful conversations that work towards the world that I have long wanted, but didn't feel the strength for a long time to do the necessary work to be a part of and to make a small contribution to. So that makes just, it's hugely meaningful to me and makes me so happy, really, to, have like, I guess, you know, when people talk about intentional weight loss and what it is to give that up, it's very easy to think of it as like, well, it just doesn't work, or, you know, it's something I have to give up for my politics. But it's like, I want to also to circle back to that question, say like, what an amazing gift when you give it up to be able to be like fully in community with people who are similarly working to be like deeply accepting and loving towards their bodies, all bodies, in a way that is, it's possible when we kind of put the personal piece of it, again, with the privilege to do so, the personal piece of it aligned with the political, and say, my body is for me. And it's also a deeply political act of resistance and coalition forming.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I feel in coalition with you. And I just want to say for you and for anyone listening, several guests and I have been talking about this idea of who's going to have money to retire. So we've decided to all form like a fat lib commune with tiny houses, and it's in the works. And I feel like when you set that kind of coalition, I'm like, yes, that we've got to all come together.
I love that so much.
Right? Yeah. We're just going to create the world that we want. All right. I'm putting you on the list. Kate, thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. And yeah, thanks so much to your listeners for being privy to this amazing conversation we got to have.
Before we go, I'd like to read a poem, because poetry can reach our hearts in a different way. Poems can have us feel in a different way. And that's what this podcast is all about. Expanding our hearts, deepening our empathy, and inviting in joy. So each week, you get a new poem. I really felt like I needed a philosophical feeling poem to close out the conversation with Kate. So I've chosen a poem called To Approach by Raquel Salas Rivera. I feel like I could read this poem again and again and get different meaning out of it every time, just like how I felt when I talked to Kate. There's just so much wisdom available, and I need to interact with it multiple times to grab it. So here's this poem called To Approach. Treatment belongs to water. It designates the sum of all relations one has with another. You might say the life schemed between two is treatment. To treat water is to cure it for consumption, but your treatment speaks volumes about your desire to bear witness. To treat you like water, I'd have to assume you as essential and daily. I aspire to this when I fall in love, that you may be my water. Since we are both from here, we are a bit contaminated, which treatment must consider. I treat you like an island looks at another and understand water is power. I know I'm mixing things, but treatment is the mixture of all the things we did to each other when they took our land, cut down our forests, and distributed our crops. It isn't a metaphor when I say crop. Sometimes it's a metaphor when I talk about us and water. It's easy to get confused with so much barnacle language stuck to our wall. Confusion is a way of getting close. If I come close, fail, and fall in love. Treatment is the sum of all relations had with each person I knew on this island. Each I loved to a greater or lesser degree. If they hurt me or took my shirt, they are still part of the treaty we signed. Thank you for joining me today. My hope is that you're feeling a little less alone and a little more seen. So until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at fatjoy.life, on YouTube at youtube.com/@fatjoy, and on Substack at fatjoy.substack.com. And please do check out the episode notes for how you can connect with my amazing guest and for the links to the poem. All right, lovely. I am sending you off with my best wishes for an abundantly fat joy day. And we'll talk again soon.